listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome to the pilot episode of The Squeaky Curd, a new food show coming to you from CGLO. We all like to eat and need food to survive, but there is so much more wrapped up in our food besides taste. The mission of this show is to take a holistic view of our relationship with food in Montreal and how it might interact with other ecological and social issues, as well as whatever other cans of worms we might open up. I'm your host, Gwen Rowley, and I'm a journalism grad student here at Concordia, and by no means a food expert. So throughout the show, I'll be consulting with experts on food studies, social justice issues, and again, whatever else we'll need to look into to better understand where our food comes from and what impact our consumption of it has. Today, we're going to be taking a look at the People's Potato, a free vegan soup kitchen based at Concordia University in Montreal, how it's coping with changes to its processes during the pandemic, and how it fits into the larger picture of issues of food insecurity and sustainability across the country during a public health crisis. Concordia's downtown campus, much like the rest of Montreal's indoor, non-retail spaces, is a ghost town, stripped down to the bare essentials to keep running. But on the seventh floor of the Henry F. Hall building, there's usually a handful of busy workers preparing food to be distributed across the city.
My name is Asiosa Irumuria. Most people know me as Sosa. I'm a collective member at the People's Potato and have been for the past 6 years. And today we're preparing what we'd like to call treats. So just like special fun things that we put in our dry bags in our food baskets. So this week it's going to be pancake mix. Last food bank it was mug cakes. And possibly next food bank it'll be hot sauce that we made ourselves.
My name is Rachel. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm a collective member here at the People's Potato. This is an off week, so we have time to package treats, and like in all of our dry bags that we give out, we have bags of rice and lentils that we give to people, and so that's something we would also bag on this week. And then on weeks it's just like getting dry bags and veg bags ready to like give to people.
The People's Potato is a free vegan soup kitchen located on Concordia's campus in the Hall building. Before the pandemic, the People's Potato provided 500 free hot vegan lunches per day. I spoke with the People's Potato financial coordinator, Iman, about how their operations have had to shift since the start of the pandemic.
My name is Iman. I use she, her pronouns, and I've been the finance coordinator at the People's Potato for close to 4 years now. I do many things like everyone else. We all contribute to the smooth functioning of the organization in terms of procuring the food and then distributing it, and in normal times processing the food as well. But we all specialize in admin and finance coordination and so on. So I do a little bit of everything.
When Iman and I spoke, she talked to me about how the People's Potato went from the early stages of the pandemic, when they didn't really have any idea of what their future would look like, to organizing into a delivery food bank that provides food to 200 people across Montreal every 2 weeks.
As of the end of February, we already sensed that our operations would have not been able to continue throughout the winter. And for the first couple months of the pandemic, we were working from home, meeting every day and trying to readjust to the new reality of working and living through a pandemic. And that's when we realized that we got inspired by other organizations that we helped throughout the summer, like Midnight Kitchen and the Concordia Food Coalition, who were already running small-scale delivery food banks. We have a garden in the summer, which is a big part of what we do in the summer months when the kitchen is closed. And we grow vegetables that usually get delivered to food banks. And this year we were delivering them through the CFC, the Concordia Food Coalition, and Midnight Kitchen for their delivery food banks. And then we decided to start our own delivery program in September, August, September. And we've been doing that since, pretty much every 2 weeks. We prepare about 200 food bags and we deliver them. And then every other week, when is our week off, we collaborate with Midnight Kitchen and help them with their food bank. We've also been sometimes continuing our what we call solidarity servings. So if there's other community organizations that hold any type of event, some they're not really events right now, but there's mostly, like, for example, demonstrations or things like that where people need food or snacks, we can make it and drop it off. So we've been doing that throughout the pandemic.
Much like with everything at this point in the pandemic, the shift was initially disorienting, but now the People's Potato seems to have adapted to their new normal.
We just had to start off like an entirely new program, try to figure it out. And luckily we have people who have the mind to do that and figure out how to work magic on Excel sheets. And it was a big change, and it was pretty stressful at first, I found, and really took a lot of energy, but I feel like we figured it out and it's going really smoothly and I'm starting to really enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. So
it's good, yeah.
Once the People's Potato was given access to their space again after the start of the fall semester, they had adapted their operations to reflect their new goals, and collective members began working on tasks like food packaging and logistical meetings. The schedule for the People's Potato involves a rotation of on and off weeks, where 1 week will be spent preparing for the upcoming food deliveries, which will happen the following week. Sosa explained more of what this looked like when I visited the People's Potato Kitchen.
It depends on the week. So we have what are called on weeks and off weeks. So this is an off week where basically preparing for food bank delivery next week. We also do a solidarity with Meals for Milton Park where we provide soup for them for like about 80 portions of soup every 2 weeks for their food basket program. We do like logistical meetings. We're a collective, so we decide everything collectively, so we're always in meetings. We do the logistical work of keeping track of our food bank users, updating addresses, confirming different things. On our on weeks, which is next week, is when we actually assemble the food baskets and deliver them, as well as have pick up at the Frigo Vare. And then everyone in the collective is in a committee or is tasked with like a certain logistical aspect of running the potato. So all three of us working today are on finance. So we take care of the bills, we cut the checks, we make sure that we're in good standing with our suppliers. I'm also on kitchen, so I order beans, I order rice, things that we put in our dry bags.
To maintain health safety for their workers and collective members, the People's Potato has split up into two bubbles that limit their interactions with each other.
Yeah, so pretty much from the beginning of the semester, we decided to split the collective into two bubbles. This is bubble A, the best bubble. But the rest of the collective is the bubble B, and we avoid contact with each other as much as possible. Like, Iman and I go to Moisson, which is the central food bank for all the food banks in the city. We go pick up the stuff, and then someone from another bubble will come down, will maintain distance while they unload the truck and bring it up and store everything. So we always, like, we always try to maintain distance between the bubbles, if not like not contact each other at all.
The People's Potato is not the only service in Montreal providing food assistance during this tumultuous time. As Sosa mentioned, there is a lot of sharing of resources with city food banks and soup kitchens, such as Meals for Milton Park and Moisson Montréal, and campus resources such as Le Frigo Vert, which provides pickup food baskets at a pay-what-you-can rate at Concordia, and Midnight Kitchen, the potatoes analog at McGill University.
Yeah, I actually wanted to clarify that with the Midnight Kitchen, we've been supporting them, but they have also started to support us, too, in our delivery runs. Mm-hmm. So they, like, do, when we do the runs, we only have one vehicle. We, for a while, were using one of our, like I was using my car, but mm-hmm. then Midnight Kitchen offered, so now we use their vehicle and they drive for us.
This community of food provisions was something that existed before the pandemic. Just on Concordia's campus, the People's Potato was part of a larger ecosystem, which included the Concordia Farmers Market, the Concordia Food Coalition, Zero Waste Concordia, Le Frigo Vert, as well as the Hive Cafe, the student cafe co-op, which also provided free lunch during pre-pandemic times and has pivoted to meal basket delivery. All of these organizations recently partnered to establish the Concordia Food Community to collaborate and share resources. Community collaboration is one of the keys to creating sustainable and ethical food systems, but the collective members talk about how this idea intersects the basic human desire to break bread with one another, as we all spend time apart during the pandemic and can't give each other the different types of comfort and support that comes from sharing a meal.
I mean, food does provide, like, in my opinion, food does provide comfort, and yeah, but like, I feel like the most important thing is like trying to guarantee survival.
Right.
Just making sure that people can live. Mm-hmm. I'm attending a conference on food security in higher education, and we always knew that there was a big need, but it's estimated that around 42% of Canadian students nationwide experience food insecurity, mm-hmm. and people who experience more food insecurity like have decreased mental and physical health, have poorer course and degree completion rates, and yeah, it just affects everything if you can't eat. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. at the very least, like, I hope I'm helping people get through this yeah. pandemic and weather the storm. Like, something like a third of Canadians like have lost a lot of money, a third have stayed the same, and then a third have made money. And like, I'm just like, what? We should focus on those people who right. are not doing so great right mm-hmm. now.
Yeah, I feel, well, especially like here, I feel like there is definitely like a sense of community. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is definitely something that is missing because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice to have that back. It's a depressing time for a lot of people.
Yeah. I can't even,
yeah.
Coming up, we'll delve more into the history of the People's Potato, the specifics of student food insecurity, and what food insecurity and sustainability looks like during a public health crisis. You're listening to CGLO, 1690 AM in Montreal. Welcome back to The Squeaky Curd. Today, we're looking at the People's Potato and how they've had to shift their operations in response to the pandemic. Before the break, we discussed how the People's Potato has shifted to a delivery-based model with new guidelines that protect the workers that prepare food for students experiencing food insecurity in Montreal. But how did the People's Potato get started? And how does their mission fit into a larger conversation about food insecurity and sustainability across Canada during a public health crisis?
Then can you maybe sum up in your own words the People's Potato's mission, your main goals?
So one of them is definitely combating food insecurity on campus and in the community as a whole. Another one that I've mentioned is definitely education on food politics and anti-oppression. Yeah, we are trying to make not only food accessible to everyone, but also to make a certain political agenda more accessible to students. And it's a political agenda that has to do with obviously anti-oppression, anti-racism, anti-capitalism, etc.
So where did this all start?
The People's Potato started in 1999, and it is a vegan soup kitchen based at Concordia University in Montreal. And it's a student initiated project. And I specify that because right now, the majority of the collective is not actually students. So it was founded in 1999. And the main reason for its inception, I would say, was addressing student poverty and the lack of healthy, affordable food on campus.
The People's Potato was started by a group of Concordia University students who wanted to provide healthy vegan foods to students with this anti-poverty, anti-oppression agenda. In giving students the option of dining at the Potato, the hope was to create an alternative to corporate food options found in the cafeterias and other places on campus.
So before the pandemic, as I mentioned, we were making food every day. Well, during the fall and winter semesters, excluding holidays, for about 400 or 500 people a day, Monday to Friday. And that was possible thanks to the help of our dedicated volunteers and obviously our workers as well. And we also had a food bank every 2 weeks, also held in our kitchen or right outside our kitchen. And we provided food to about 100-150 people through our food bank.
Beyond its goals of food provision and security, before the pandemic, the People's Potato was also providing educational resources on food justice with a political bent that supports, as Iman said, anti-poverty, anti-capitalism, and anti-oppression by providing workshops for the student population. These workshops would prioritize Black, Indigenous, and other marginalized voices and would sometimes focus on political food education, but would also just be about teaching people how to create their own food at home, with lessons on fermentation, homemade empanadas, and things like that. Since 1999, the Potato has shifted from a mostly volunteer-run organization to a workers' collective where members make decisions for the kitchen and delegate tasks in an egalitarian manner. Iman pointed out, though, that they still rely heavily on the labor of volunteers. Most of the collective members now are not students.
I think it happened quite organically because I think they realized that realistically, students don't have a lot of time. And the People's Potato is quite a large organization that requires people to be able to work full time. So we've always been quite serious about having student representation through our board and also always allowing a few students to work part-time. But the reality of our organization is that we need people to work full-time. And that is not something that's compatible with being a student for the most part.
Lack of student resources and time is also something that plays into the larger issue of student food insecurity. Different groups face food insecurity for different reasons. For example, low-income groups face food insecurity not just because they can't afford food, but also because they might be living in lower-cost areas classified as food deserts, where there is less access to healthy, nutritious food close by. I spoke with Erica Calder, a PhD candidate at the University of Waterloo, studying food sovereignty, and her supervisor, Stephanie Scott, about how food insecurity affects students and how it fits into a larger picture of food justice, food sovereignty, and sustainability.
So I'm Erica. I identify as a cisgendered female and as a racialized person with mixed Black, Indigenous, and white heritage. I'm currently a PhD student at Waterloo University. My research focuses on Black and Indigenous food sovereignty, primarily in Canada. I also work part-time as a research assistant with Stephanie and as a policy advisor for Food Secure Canada. I also work with the Black Food Sovereignty Alliance Toronto, which is headed by Anand Lalawi of African Food Baskets. And they are building a Black Food Sovereignty Plan for Toronto in a relationship with the city's anti-Black racism unit.
I'm Stephanie Scott, and I am a professor in geography and environmental management at the University of Waterloo, which is in the Faculty of Environment. Yeah, in terms of my research focus, it's shifted a bit, but for many years I've been working on food systems kind of research in a variety of contexts, international and Canada.
Here's what they had to say about food insecurity faced by students.
There are a few specific factors like time scarcity. They're often working in precarious jobs with low wages and multiple jobs, and then at the same time trying to go through school and or support themselves, or perhaps in codependent relationships with family or other partners, and perhaps living in desert areas that could be classified as food deserts. So in times of economic stress, like a pandemic, they're really likely to face additional difficulties, say in employment or food access, mental health. And they may face some difficult choices in turn, like whether to return home if they've been studying abroad, to take on high-risk informal jobs, to consider self-harm or suicide, to eat poorly, to eat less, to get involved in crime or substance abuse. There's all sorts of issues that students could be facing if they aren't well supported at a critical time like this.
But if we think about the opportunities, we have thousands and thousands of students across the country, hundreds of thousands of students across Canada, for example, who are typically attending campus. And so there's a tremendous potential to feed those students well. But I say potential because often not realized, perhaps. But also, if we think back to, say, procurement and the supply chains that are supplying those, university cafeterias and food outlets. And so, again, if we think about, mandating, good food supply that can be sourced from producers that have, a certain set of practices, ecologically and socially, and for example, supporting local growers in all those areas. Again, there's a huge potential to have really positive spin-offs for our food systems.
Of course, food insecurity is not an issue that only impacts students. When I first started working on this episode, I underline again my lack of expertise, I was under the impression that food insecurity just meant not having enough to eat. And while this is part of the issue for sure, when considering food security, we need to take into account things like access and the actual nutritional value of the food people have access to. Here's what Stephanie had to say about food security.
If you go to what the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has to say, they'll talk about how food security is when, all people at all times have physical and social and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. And then some people kind of expand on that and sort of spell out sort of four pillars of food security, because you need to have food that's available, as a thinking about the food supply, a physical inflow or presence of safe and nutritious food in a time and a place. So in other words, we need, markets to be operating often. We can also think about a pillar of food access, right? Because if, there may be a supply of food, but if people don't, and again, in a market economy, have the ability to purchase or exchange for foods or even foods that are given or gifted, those kind of social mechanisms, need to exist in order to enable that, distribution of food, even among members of a household. And then in addition to availability and access, we can think about utilization, right? That, which kind of relates to our own bodies, right? We need to be able to make the most of the nutrients in the food that we consume. So food has to be properly stored so it doesn't spoil. It needs to be appropriately cooked so that it's safe to eat and free of disease. And then if we are, say, immune compromised, we might have more challenges consuming certain foods, like, for example, people who can't consume gluten. And so we have to, again, think about how our body is going to utilize that food. And then finally, as a fourth pillar beyond those three, people talk about stability. In other words, that kind of cuts across all of those other components. Food may be available, may be accessible, maybe we're able to utilize it, but but there's, you know, shocks or fluctuations over time, you know, that may be due to any number of kind of crises, you know, political, different disasters, boycotts, any number of things that can affect that supply over time. So in other words, like addressing the potential for vulnerability and all those others.
If we're talking about food security in terms of access, it needs to be acknowledged that historically, the people who have had less access to social, political, and economical resources will have less consistent access to nutritious food. Iman talks about why the acknowledgement of this fact has been at the core of the People's Potatoes philosophy and mission.
Marginalized groups are obviously the ones who are not only more physically distant from food sources. So there's like a close relationship between food deserts, so areas where there's no access to fresh food. And these areas are usually where recently landed immigrants and like people of color tend to live, because they're cheaper to afford, you know? And so that, in a way, affects their access to food. So it's huge. We are trying to address it in a sense. We're quite central, which makes us a good hub for people, or at least we used to be a hub for people to come and get their food and their food baskets every 2 weeks. And now we're trying to get food to people through our delivery food bank. And a lot of the people that we do serve live in faraway areas of Montreal.
Food security for historically racialized and marginalized groups intersects with Erica Calder's main topic of study, food sovereignty. The way that Erica explains it, the original framing of the idea of food security when it became a common term in the middle of the 20th century in response to the Green Revolution, placed emphasis on technological advancement and an increase in industrial food production. This on its own led to an increase in the use of low-wage labor by migrant workers, while still not addressing the root of the problems of access, as the lens was still focused mainly on the perspective of white people and the upper and middle classes. As the focus has shifted to include more voices of BIPOC and other groups that had a historically inequitable access to food and other resources, food justice movement participants began to realize that state and other establishment-led initiatives for food security did not take equitable approaches to solving issues of continuous access to nutritious food. This caused many communities to look within themselves to find their own solutions to issues of access to food, searching for sovereign decision-making that acknowledges past injustices.
Food security is often the framework used at governance levels from global to municipal to guide food system planning. However, food security is an ideology that doesn't fully acknowledge inequity and power and wealth, the centrality of racism and that inequity, and the fundamental role of the state in regulating status quo. So what most racialized communities are now calling for is a recognition of their rights as sovereign peoples to produce their own foods through their own means, for their own purposes, and to the economic benefit of their own communities to define their own food systems. For Indigenous people, this refers to broader territorial land rights and uses of the land for food purposes. And for Black people, this refers to acknowledgement of their unique status as a Pan-African ancestral group brought here against their will through slavery. What both groups share in common are displacement of land, oppression of culture, stealing, raping, genocide of their people, and policies that forbade them from owning land, practicing traditions, and accumulating wealth, for starters. At the same time, their traditional knowledge, agroecological methods, and values in resource conservation and stewardship are what modern-day agricultural systems are based on and have been exploited. At the same time, there needs to be continual pressure and momentum in confronting white supremacy and racist narratives that facilitated those events in the past and continue to threaten the well-being, livelihood, and lives of racialized individuals still today.
The corporate and colonial foundations of the food systems in North America created a framework that clashes with a lot of attempts to secure continuous access to nutritious foods for historically marginalized groups. Food sovereignty is a response to this type of inequity with a lot of elements that reach beyond the scope of this story, but hopefully we will be discussing it in a future episode. But if we're talking about food equity and we're talking about food security, it's also worth addressing sustainability, because incorporating a fairer, more reliable food system needs to be built to last. Here's how Erica envisions a sustainable, equitable food system.
Not only do we have a responsibility with in sustainable community food systems to our own community, our local community, but also our purchasing power should both protect local and global producers. We also want to remember that we're on this path of like a colonial history, where less developed nations have been exploited and continue to face inequities in power and wealth with more developed countries. So a sustainable community food system would recognize those historical inequities, both without and within. And here in Canada, more broadly North America, we have a huge debt to pay to Indigenous, Black, and other racialized communities who have largely contributed to building the agricultural base and economic wealth of the country. And my territorial claims have not been resolved either.
As we mentioned before, the people's potato itself is part of a larger food system at Concordia and in Montreal. In its attempts to eliminate hunger and oppression with healthy, locally sourced meals on the university's campus, it also contributes to the relationship with some of Concordia's other food providers and plays a factor in how sustainable the food system is. Here's how Aman described a sustainable food system.
Yeah, this is definitely more of a personal that I will give you. It's definitely a food system that prioritizes local food and it prioritizes not only sourcing locally, but also like distributing food locally as much as possible. And it decentralizes, food sources from big corporations to more community-run initiatives. So the People's Potato is definitely an example of that, as well as the Hive Cafe at Concordia and the Hive Free Lunch at Loyola. And we have a few organizations already. I feel like Concordia is really ahead of the game when it comes to student-run and community-based food systems.
While far from being perfectly ethical and sustainable, students living in residence are still required to buy a meal plan from the corporation Aramark, which has its own string of scandals for the way it services clients in prisons and nursing homes. With all of the alternative options that are available, Iman said she felt like Concordia was ahead of the curve. I also spoke with Eric Chevrier, a PhD candidate at Concordia, who agrees that the campus does have many different food operations which are making a better difference in the world. Here's what Eric had to say about what makes for a sustainable food system.
Yeah, so my name is Eric Chevrier. I'm a part-time professor at Concordia. I'm also a PhD candidate, and I'm specializing in food systems. So sustainability is not just, you know, reducing the amount of plastic or, you know, just being a little bit more environmentally friendly by composting. You know, these are kind of surface issues. The real issues is that we actually have to look at social justice. You know, the food system is rooted in colonization and racism. And the extent is, you know, when Europeans came to colonize North America or so-called North America, they brought with them slaves from Africa. And these slaves were actually put to work on plantations and as well, basically on the food systems to drive down the cost of labor. And you know, that had an effect on our economic system, because food costs are one of the ways that we measure, you know, the livelihood of workers. So when we drive down these costs, then, you know, the whole kind of capitalist industries could then pay workers less because they don't need as much or they don't meet the cost of these food. They're not paying the true cost. And therefore it drives down labor costs across the board. Now, these are kind of built into the structure of our food system. And, you know, we've come across these issues, like a lot of consumers want cheaper costs of food. And, you know, this is part of our understanding is that, you know, the priority is actually to try to get food as cheap as possible so that people could afford it. But the reality is what we need to do is bring up people's standard of living and bring up people's wages, because we're driving down the cost of food to the extent that we're not really paying the true cost. We're externalizing all of the actual costs of food, and it has a negative effect.
Again, Eric agrees with Aman that one of the most important steps to creating a sustainable food system is localizing.
So I do think that localizing our food systems will have a positive impact. And I believe that actually connecting people to their food, first of all, will educate people about what goes into food processes. A lot of people are disconnected from this, to the extent that we go to the grocery store and all of these processed things are available, but we don't really know how they come into fruition. And, you know, a lot of people don't think about these things, especially because it could cause cognitive dissonance. You don't want to know that animals have been treated, you know, incorrectly or inhumanely. So we want to disconnect ourselves a lot of the time from the processes of food. And what I try to encourage my students to do, but, you know, people in general, is to actually reconnect to these processes. You know, it's very easy to produce food. You know, for example, I produce food in my own backyard, and people could do that if they have access to space. But we could also reproduce food in our own communities as well.
As with everything in the past year, all of these factors, food security, sustainability, and equity, have been impacted by the emergence of the pandemic. Not only has it disrupted the food supply chain by imposing new restrictions for people who work with food, but the strain that existed for many people pre-pandemic when it came to accessing food was only increased when the pandemic hit. Here's what Aman had to say about what she saw with the potatoes users.
It has been a time of extreme uncertainty on all levels, and it has been very, very straining financially to most people, and especially to people who were already in precarious positions in society. So it has been particularly hard for students, but it has been particularly hard for like the homeless population and immigrants, and people were already struggling. So it has become even more important right now to provide affordable food to all those who need it.
Here's what Stephanie had to say.
Not to mention the challenges of like access to food for people who had mobility issues and immune compromised systems. And so it was risky or difficult for them to get to the grocery stores to do their regular food shopping. And then like low-income people who, you know, maybe lost their income, were out of work or out of income. And so then, yeah, how were they going to get food, having to rely on food banks or such? So all kinds of challenges there.
Here's some insight from Erica.
Like in terms of, the racial divide, that there's definitely evidence that has come through that inequities based on racial divide are just heightened and expanded under COVID, whether it's people who are unemployed, people who are facing food insecurity, people who are facing health impacts, or losing their businesses. That's just kind of illuminated the problems that already exist in the food system and the food supply chain. And so, there's definitely a lot of evidence there, and, you know, exactly how that's going to change really has to do with how we frame the problems and then therefore the solutions and moving forward, which is really why, for example, like the organization that I'm working with, the Black Food Sovereignty Alliance, is really pushing for a Black Food Sovereignty plan. And I believe with Indigenous communities, they also have similar plans that they are promoting, because it really talks about the economic self-sufficiency of those communities and their ability to drive their own self-determination in ways that the state hasn't been able to do so far, and it have really, under the conditions of a pandemic, put so many lives at stake.
And here's what Eric had to add.
Other things, though, is that we noticed prices of food are increasing also. So it's being difficult to manage supply chains. Grocery stores are charging exorbitant amounts of money. And, you know, at the same time as the food prices are increasing, grocery stores are making more profits than they ever have before also. So, you know, this is an extent of price gouging, but at the same time, you know, people are trying to profit as best as possible, and they take advantage of situations like the pandemic. So look, it's not that it's positive or negative. You know, obviously the pandemic has really impacted society in very negative fashion. And it's changed the way that people interact with food. You know, just in a basic level, our restaurants were forced to close. And because of that, it's impacted the restaurant industry. So I think food is part and parcel of a larger conversation about how, you know, the pandemic has affected people politically and economically. But it is definitely, you know, one of the main or a main industry of importance, because it actually is what sustains us as people.
This can paint a pretty depressing, horrifying picture, and it would be difficult to sum up the loss and hardship communities have faced during the pandemic in just a one-hour radio show about food. But having the status quo shift has also made people reassess their food system in ways that are having a positive impact on food sustainability and security. More on this after the break. You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Welcome back to The Squeaky Curd. Before the break, we looked at the People's Potatoes mission, how it intersected with larger ideas about food security and sustainability, and how all of this has been impacted by the pandemic. To give all of us a little bit of a break, it's worth mentioning that despite the obvious negative effects we've seen wreaked by a year living with the threat of COVID-19, we can pull some aspects of positivity. Not only have organizations like the People's Potato adapted to provide food to populations facing insecurity, but people have started to look inward to community and self-sufficiency when it comes to where they get their food.
You know, in a positive extent, it seems that actually people are more driven now to do urban agriculture or to actually produce or connect with their own food. And, you know, there's a lot of indicators of this. There's actually right now kind of a crisis when it comes to buying seeds. It seems that a lot of the places that usually are overstocked are selling out now. Plant supply stores and things like this are also reporting the same thing. So it looks like people are trying to connect better to their food and actually start to produce things on their own.
Erica and Stephanie observed this same trend with stocking up on seeds, as well as a newfound taste for foraging and food sourced and sold locally, sometimes at a safe outdoor market. Although they did point out there was some hypocrisy when it came to how these markets and gardens were regulated when it came to COVID-19 restrictions.
I remember how, in what ways do people experience food insecurity when the pandemic started? So they shut down all the community gardens. And that was really interesting that one thing that we'd observed was that food retailers were able to, like large food retailers were continuing to, were able to continue to operate. But the markets were shut down, and producers and people working in different organizations. Who really pushed that? There was one organization in particular that really pushed that.
That pushed for farmers markets to open.
Open, yeah. Is it Ontario Farmers Network or OFN? No. Well, there had to be some like political some advocacy from the ground up in order to kind of push for accountability on getting those markets up and running and on being able to have the guidance from public health to run markets. But even then, the people were kind of left in a lurch and kind of had to pivot. With their own knowledge and adapt, and some people were able to succeed and some people weren't, and a lot of people had to move into hybrid models.
So where does all this leave us? How can consumers, still in the middle of a pandemic, create and access food systems that are sustainable, avoid corporate interest, and put the needs of the most historically marginalized first? Making your decisions of where you source your food just based off of these few questions might be the best place to start.
I don't want people to have this kind of doom and gloom scenario. So some of these problems are able to be solved, but we have to think of collectivity. So not to say that we shouldn't think of things as individual problems, but largely companies try to blame individuals and make them feel bad for their own practices. So, you know, for example, there's been kind of like this push towards, more sustainable consumption, like reducing plastic use and going towards zero waste and all of these things. And look, these are positive endeavors, and I think people should be doing this. But I think this is a basic necessity. And I think that we need to think beyond these things also. And we really need to root our understanding in social justice and anti-oppression and, you know, things that are large, large issues, but are more deal more with the root of the problem rather than just the surface.
Remembering that while this is a conversation about whether or not people go hungry, the way we source food has impacts on the environment that we might not even see or think about when we're making our food decisions.
Well, I mean, I know the other kind of elephant in the room that has been often ignored over the last year is climate crisis. And so lots of efforts to try to put that back on the agenda
and figure out what does that mean for our food systems. So regenerative agriculture is a big piece of that, you know, perennial growing and opportunities for carbon sequestration, and then reducing emissions reducing food waste is another thing we haven't touched on, but that again has huge implications for emissions.
Rethinking which foods should be prioritized and why a producer might be prioritizing it to its consumers.
And I think the interesting opportunities in that regard are maybe less about consumer education, because that doesn't necessarily change behavior very fast, but thinking about what food is like changing the defaults of what's offered. For example, you know, there's been studies in cafeterias in which, you know, if the non-meat options are like put up front and then people are like going through a cafeteria and mostly filled up their plate with the non-meat options and then the meat is offered last, then they often will eat less meat. And you know, the same thing could be set up in terms of healthier food options, like making the healthier food options the default options. So not putting, you know, the candy bars at the checkout, right? But providing people with fresh fruit and vegetables and such.
Always keeping the lens of anti-racism and anti-oppression, recognizing that not only were these inequitable food systems built on Black, Indigenous, and other marginalized groups' labor and suffering, but they are now also more likely to be experiencing food insecurity because of that history.
Yeah, definitely applying an anti-racism and Indigenous equity lens to food systems planning, I think, is one piece that it, like, we've been looking at, like myself, Stephanie, and our fellow researchers and organizations that we're working with. There's not a lot of working examples for how to mainstream that, how to move that into municipal and regional food system planning in a good way that respects the autonomy of different communities, and that respects Indigenous territorial rights as well. So there's a lot of work to be done in terms of figuring out how that can be done well.
And so, after all this, where does this leave the people's potato as we continue to adapt to life in a pandemic? Here's how Aman sees the future of the kitchen.
I'd say as soon as we're able to return to the kitchen safely, we'll probably do that. But I don't know when that's gonna happen. It's probably not gonna happen in the fall. That is my personal opinion, but who knows? until then, we'll just continue our operations the way we have been doing the last year or so. In the long term, we've learned so much through this pandemic. Now we know that if there is another pandemic in the future, we can still, it was really unsettling when it all started. We had no idea if we were thinking that the People's Potato would have not survived. And that basically we would have never been able to go back to the kitchen and continue our work, which wasn't the case. So that is wonderful. But it has taught us a lot about how resilient community organizations can be. And we really had the opportunity to reinvent ourselves and keep working in very difficult circumstances, I would say. But we've been lucky because we had the support of Concordia, and we had enough people willing to do the work and to continue working. So that's something that I see will help us in the future, no matter what happens. So we already have a waiting list for our food bank because we're only 7 workers and we only have mm-hmm. 1 van. So there's only so much we can do right now, but we are hoping to be able to expand our operations, get a second vehicle, and potentially more drivers so that we can reach as many people as possible.
The collective members are also hoping to return to the community garden on Loyola campus this summer. And depending on what public health regulations are in place in Quebec at that time, they also hope to greet their volunteers there in person. Here's what Rachel and Soza had to say.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that as long as there's a pandemic, we're still doing this as much as we can. Mm-hmm. Over the summers, there'll be a little less because we don't have that many people working. We might do food bank pickups, mm-hmm. which we are currently doing, but maybe more people will move to that, and that's something we could continue. But yeah, so our capacity in the summer is not the same.
Right.
But then, I mean, post-pandemic, I would love to get back to cooking for 500 people a day. I miss that.
Yeah.
And like have volunteers in here again. It would be so nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to things going back to normal and like really knowing what my job is.
Yeah. Part of the reason why I like working at the Potato is that I really feel that we try to cultivate a community here. Mm-hmm. So I miss our volunteers. Like, yeah, there are a lot of rad people who come here regularly, mm-hmm. and it's always nice to share time with them. And yeah, I miss the meals, like cooking every day, like. Yeah, I like cooking. Like, I'm, like, all of my career, I've been a cook. So, mm-hmm. like, that's my background. So not actually, like, doing the physical action of, like, trying to prepare good food in a certain amount of time. I miss it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of The Squeaky Curd. Today's episode wouldn't have been possible without the participation of Iman, Rachel, Soza, Erica Calder, Eric Chevrier, and Stephanie Scott. You can check out Erica's work along with others by going to foodsecurecanada.org and learn more about her work with the Black Food Sovereignty Alliance Toronto at blackfoodtoronto.com. You can take a look at Eric's work by going to ericchevrier.ca. A special thanks to the People's Potato for giving me access to their kitchen during public health building restrictions. Our show illustration and logo were designed by Christina Rivera. If you or someone you know in Montreal is experiencing food insecurity, the People's Potato is currently at capacity, but you can join their waitlist at peoplespotato.com. And if you access the Squeaky Curds page on the CGLO website, there will be a link to a Montreal food resources sheet, which is broken down by neighborhood, provided by the People's Potato. Please join us next week as we take a look at foods we eat to celebrate the transition from winter to spring. From Gwen Rowley, you're listening to CGLO, 1690 AM in Montreal.